we have a little bit of a...
Now we have to send that down.
We are going to open the Senate Committee on Education today, the 20th of February 2015. And with that, we have a number of bills. Some of them say possible work sessions. As I have talked to people and amendments are necessary, there will be only public hearings today. Which one is his? The first one? Okay. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122. And with that, we'll have a short explanation of the bill from our committee administrator. And if Senator Hensel wants to come up and take a seat and bring anybody you want with you if you need to support people with you. Yeah. But we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 122 creates an income tax credit for classroom expenses of educators and parents. It may have a fiscal impact and may have revenue impact, but statements have not yet been issued. We're not considering any amendments at this time.
Okay, with that.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. For the record, my name is Senator Bill Hansel of District 29. The purpose of Senate Bill 122 is to ensure that educators and parents alike are able to support our children and further their educational achievements. Our children, as we all know, are the future of our state and country. With such growing costs in education, there are some aspects that get overlooked and come at additional expenses for our teachers and parents. School supplies such as pencil, pens, markers, getting the classroom in shape, paper sometimes come in short supply. The teachers turn to their own pockets to fill the need. Mm-hmm. It is my hope that we would support this bill, not only for our teachers that work so hard, but also for the children's minds they shape and futures they hold. It is a fairness issue for me. Most of us can think back and remember at least one dedicated teacher who used their own money to buy school supplies for disadvantaged kids in their classroom. Again, this is a fairness bill. They do so much for our children that it is time that we properly thank these dedicated public servants by helping them for the sacrifices they make to prepare our children and grandchildren for a bright future. I might mention also that my office was contacted by Mr. Roger Williams, one of the Oregon Christian Home Educator Association Network. According to his email, they have 50 affiliated support groups statewide, and he asked that the homeschoolers be taken out of the bill. I left it in for two reasons. Number one, the program is totally voluntary. You don't have to do it if you don't want to. And number two, I talked with an active Christian homeschooler in my district who supported the bill. So I think that there's probably a wide range of interest within the homeschooler community. And again, the whole thing is voluntary. I am more than happy to answer, try to answer any questions that you might have about this bill. And that concludes my testimony.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Betscher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hansel, there's a difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction. And I'm just kind of wondering why this wouldn't be a tax deduction instead of a tax credit. It's a tax credit. It's just two different things. So normally in a business setting, this would be a deduction, an allowable deduction.
I would leave it up to the discretion of the – I put the tax credit in to get the bill going. If you'd rather have it as a tax deduction, I think a tax credit helps a little more for the educator, for the teacher, and I wanted to start there on the discussion.
Yes, follow up. Senator Betscher.
So as we have that discussion, so a deduction, if they spend $100 on supplies, they're allowed to take $100 and deduct it from their adjusted income. You know, so I think that should be maybe, that might be a little more palatable.
Understand.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, the parent part of this, I'm curious. I've been fairly involved with the local education foundation. Would this include contributions to a foundation which are tax deduction now and usually flow through to the school?
That was not the intent. If I have overlooked something here or if we need to shore this up, that would be fine. That was not the purpose for that. More the parent was more of the what primarily focused on homeschooling. been my idea. So
I appreciate your efforts. I know that most of my friends that are teachers seem to spend about $1,000 to $2,500 a year to buy supplies for their classrooms because they're inadequate.
And that's the thrust, Senator Byer, Chair Roblin, of what I'm trying to get here is to help incentivize and help some of our great teachers.
Sort of a backdoor way to increase the education fund.
Senator Bearshear.
You know, I look forward to working with you on this bill to compensate, you know, teachers or educators that are literally taking money out of their pocket to put it in the classroom. But unfortunately, it gets complicated when you deal with tax issues, because if we do a deduction, then that's a line item deduction, and somebody that files a simple tax return, that turns into something else. So, yeah, we got some work to do, Senator Hansel, but I'd be glad to work with you on it.
Thank you. I realize that. I'm trying to help, and I don't care how that help ends up being at the end of the day, but and that's part of the reason we have these hearings.
Any further questions? I guess my only question is that I have some legislative interns. They work really hard. So I said, isn't there a federal deduction for supplies from teachers? And they came to the conclusion, yes, there is. And so there are other deductions. And would they get it for both? So they get a tax credit, which is exactly the total amount, and then they get a tax deduction on their federal income tax. So they actually make money on giving money. I couldn't figure out from this bill if that could happen, but it looked like it could.
I don't know.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, because I think there are some other kinds of things. There's a lot of groups of people who have tried to help teachers, because I think everybody in the country actually knows that public teachers actually spend more money in the classroom than they get than the classroom is provided. So they always are supplementing. You know, if you go in and a teacher retires, half the library that's in their room leaves because they bought all those books and they were there for those teachers. So I think we all have the same kind of interest there. We just have to figure out how would we go about doing this in a way would work. So.
And I'm happy to work with you, Senator.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. We have one other person, Lori Wimmer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 42,000 teachers and other education employees in our schools and community colleges, here today to perhaps surprise you. We are not in favor of this bill, even though we are very grateful for the sentiment and the ideas that were meant to help out and recognize our members who do, as a matter of fact, contribute well over the 250 that would be in the credit. My members not only contribute an average of $900 a year out of pocket to enhance their classrooms and their students' educational experiences, but they've also created a number of years ago a foundation, the OEA Foundation, which they also contribute to every year, and that foundation supplies things like winter coats and eyeglasses, and I saw this year even a cochlear implant for students who can't afford those kinds of things, and so every year teachers nominate students in their class to receive these ideas. So as you can see, they are altruistic in the extreme. They care very much about their students, and they do these things willingly. It's not that they don't deserve some reimbursement for their generosity. They do. But it's not their highest priority. Their highest priority, however, is that the students deserve an adequately funded education. And the reason I raise that is that this is the top of their wish list for Santa. Class sizes small enough to offer individualized attention to their students who need it. Restoration of electives and enrichments and activities that inspire those students. The end to heavily scripted curricula and high-stakes testing and labeling. Time to collaborate with their colleagues, to plan, to fine-tune their craft. The end to poverty that causes their students to experience hunger, homelessness, and illness. They want respect for their expertise and an end to top-down micromanagement and universal full-day kindergarten across the state and safe and healthy buildings for their students to learn in that are not outdated technologically or overcrowded. When Oregon experienced the most recent recession and its aftermath, we lost 5,000 educators in Oregon's public schools. And though we are climbing out of that dark day, we have not yet achieved the kind of funding levels that we had prior to that recession, and we have not restored all those jobs. And we know that the current co-chair framework doesn't get us to even a no-cuts level for the place we are right now at 7.26. I know they care very much about our schools, but they don't have the resources to get to the 7.5 we need to have a no-cuts budget, we're told. So we can hardly see how offering a 373rd tax credit or tax break in our tax expenditures collection would in any way solve that problem. So rather than add to the overall general fund insufficiency, we would rather Oregonians work together to ensure that sufficient resources exist to fund our schools adequately. And if this bill is to move forward in some shape to the Revenue Committee, we would hope that it would be another tax break of equal value would be found to cancel it to at least ensure revenue neutrality so that we don't dig the hole deeper. I did a little back of the napkin math. We have about 550,000 students in Oregon's public schools, just for the public school side of this. I know it also would be for private school students. If each one of their parents took their $250 maximum tax credit, that would cost the state $137.5 million a year, just for the parent side of it. If 26,000 teachers took it, it would be another $6.5 million a year. Again, we'd ask that we stop digging and fund schools adequately. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Laura. So is there anyone else that wanted to come and testify on Senate Bill 122? Come on up and make sure you just give us your name so we can get that on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deanna Mack for the record with Department of Revenue. And we just had a couple of questions, wanted to get some clarifying information from you as you develop your policy on this particular credit. One, as far as the parent goes, does the parent also, would the parent's expenses include the parent the expenses of their own child, or would it be for the credits, the expenses they donate to the classroom, like what the teacher does? Some clarity on there, and also some clarity on whether if it's a joint tax return, if each taxpayer gets to claim $250, or if they, if you intend it to be a $500 credit on a joint tax return or not. Just getting that on the record, food for thought, if you wouldn't mind considering that.
I, for one, thank you very much for being here and
yes.
taking note that it was here,
yes.
Because if we don't get that stuff clarified, it takes other time. So any questions for Department of Revenue? Thank you very
thank you.
Much for being here. Again, anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 122? Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 122. Senator Hansel, thank you very much for coming, and we look forward to talking to you, and we'll see where we're going to go from here. Okay. With that, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 44. We'll have a short explanation of the bill, and we'll go from there.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 44 extends tax credits for University Venture Development Fund contributions. It does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. It may have a fiscal and revenue impact, but statements have not yet been issued, and we are considering some Dash 1 amendments at this time.
So, Chris,
it's a small amount.
Alnick? Yeah, there you are. There's Chris.
Not very much money, actually. $250.
And we could have Chuck Williams. Is Chuck here, too? You can come on up, too. Oh, wait. We'll keep you. Chuck, we'll wait for you to be with the other three. We'll let
on the last one.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Alnick, Legislative Revenue Office. And I was asked to spend a couple minutes and give an overview of tax credit report. I believe you have a section of it in Olas, and I know a few members up there have already heard me kind of give this spiel before. But from 2013, House Bill 2002 required the Legislative Revenue Office to produce a in-depth report on the tax credits that are scheduled for sunset. So we released that report to the revenue committees last week, and it is a detailed report on the 18 credits that are scheduling to sunset. One of them is the University Venture Development Fund. And that report just provides some information on an interpretation of the policy purpose. The end goal is to evaluate each of these tax credits and to whether or not they are achieving their purpose. Usually, tax credits do not contain a purpose in statute. So what I did for the report was I went back to the implementing legislation and took a stab at the policy purpose. This particular credit that you're hearing today does have a policy purpose in statute. But the real goal for all of this session among all the committees is to get as clearly as possible a statement of intent or purpose or goal for the tax credits so that they can be evaluated to determine whether or not they achieve those goals or how they should be modified or whether or not they should be allowed to sunset. And so that's kind of the gist of it. And one thing that's different for that you may or may not be aware of is that we did get an additional staff person. And this time around, as compared to 11 and 13, I'm tracking the tax credits and I'm available to the policy committees to the extent you would like help from LRO on crafting policies or making changes to them as you discuss them and determine whether or not they should be forwarded on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And Senator Bearsugar.
Do you have any examples of how this tax credit's been used off the top of your head?
Well, I believe you're going to hear some testimony from the school system. They can probably better answer that question.
Okay.
Are you kind of the projects that are taking advantage of the?
Yeah.
I believe you're going to hear some testimony that can better answer that question than I can at the moment.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? I appreciate this inclusion and the opportunity to have people from your office come and talk about these, because it's always been an issue with policy commissions in general. We end up doing them and we like the idea, but we really don't have any clue about the ramifications and how it will fit into the other thing. So we send them off to revenue, who then talks about the cost and all those other kinds of things, but not necessarily how to put that policy ahead of another policy or whatever. So having this conversation is going to be very helpful.
And Chair Roblin, I think that's part of the intent in the discussion already, the difference between a deduction and a credit, some of the interpretation of current law or some of the amendments. I'll be as available as I can to help that process at this stage before it goes on.
Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, it may be too early to tell this, but because this tax credit has a payback provision, can you talk about how that's worked so far?
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, I can touch on it briefly. I think you're going to hear some testimony that'll better answer it. The payback period was almost kind of a potentially create a revolving fund. As the payback comes back to the general fund, there's more room in the cap for the tax credits to be issued, because there is a program cap on the amount of tax credits that can be issued. There are kind of two pots, one for OHSU, one for the other universities. And through that payback process, it would almost possibly be described as a self-funding mechanism. That payback period really depends on the nature of projects. And because the funding here is for the proof of concept stage of these developments. And so there can be a longer term payback for when the money would come back to the general fund. I believe it's 20% of the revenue that comes in needs to be paid back to the general fund.
And we don't have a long enough history to know whether that's occurring or how much money that's.
I believe a few hundred thousand, off the top of my head, I believe a few hundred thousand dollars. Well, there has been a relatively small amount of money paid back to the general fund. I think there are other people in the room who can provide an exact answer.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Sure.
So with that, we have a panel. It's Chuck Williams, Michael Morish, Brian Wall.
Senator Girard in the audience.
Pardon?
Senator Girard's in the audience. I don't know if he wants to talk.
Oh, that's right.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and Senate Committee, for allowing us the chance to give you some additional information on this tax credit. Good questions, Senator Beyer. I think there's probably a lot more to come from. So I'll give you kind of the background history of this, and we have provided some written materials as well, I believe, as well as a kind of a timeline for how this typically works. My name is Brian Wall. I'm with Oregon State University as an Assistant Vice President for Research, Commercialization, and Industry Partnerships. And I'd like to start by first saying I'm representing actually all of the universities with my colleague Chuck Williams, U of O, here today. But this is a joint collaboration between all of the universities in the state of Oregon who are also raising these types of funds and expending those to create impact in the state. We've worked collaboratively on this in the past, and we continue to work collaboratively today. So kind of at a high level, universities receive a significant amount of federal funding. We're expanding more and more into industry funding, corporate funding for research purposes, but in general, there has never been funding that's been dedicated for early stage, high risk, high application type research. And so this fund was created several years ago and was launched effectively by the universities going in fundraising in 2008 is when the fundraising really started. We went out and raised a fair amount of funding over the time period, about $7 million collectively. We've deployed a significant amount of that. The intent really is to try to find research. There's twofold. Try to find research at universities that have already reached a level of kind of basic research results that show their significant potential impact across a range of markets, a range of areas. And you have to figure out at the end of the day, most of the times faculty publish papers on it and continue to increase the state of the art for research. This fund really, the core focus is to try to take all of those fields and really, we each have different committee or different advisory councils formed of entrepreneurs and investors, and we work with the faculty to try to fine-tune that research into a core market and figure out how do we invest a limited amount of this funding and see if the basic research results actually apply to a specific market that could potentially have an impact in the state of Oregon. And so that's one core set of how we use the fund. The other core set is entrepreneurial education. And so as we're funding these applied research projects and we're making relationships with investors and entrepreneurs, we're actually inviting those real-world projects into our classrooms. And so we're impacting students by bringing in real-world ideas, bringing in the investors, bringing in the entrepreneurs, and using these as real-world training ground for students that are studying markets. They do business plans on them. We hire interns with some of this funding to actually give real-world education on this. So the challenge always is, and you might have heard this from some of the other like signature research centers, this is really what's called the valley of death. There's no investment from federal government in this area, and there's definitely no investment from companies, and there's no investment from investors, because it's way too early stage to figure out, is this really even going to work in my specific market? So this is the only fund that's available for universities to really take that, $800+ million of research on an annual basis and try to figure out what actually is going to work and de-risk it enough to attract entrepreneurs and investors to come in and take it forward on the next stage. We have returned, even though it started in 2008, our timeline typically for when an idea arises or an innovation at a university, it takes 8, 10, 12 years before we really see it hit a market. It takes a long time. This is, you know, highly technical scientific ideas. It takes a long time to get to proof of concepts and then to the market. even though we started in 2008, we've raised $7 million. We have, excuse me, there's the chart. We have returned just approximately $500,000. You'll see handouts from the universities. There's been a significant number of companies that have either launched because they've had access to this fund, or they've benefited from the research and decided to actually that the risk was sufficient enough to then launch the companies. And so this chart here really just shows the timeline, where the fund fits in, where we work collaboratively with signature research centers like ONAMI, Oregon Best, and Otrati, how a company gets launched, and when they start producing product or services, and start providing funding back into the license agreements, then we start returning funds back into the state to continue the cycle here. So I think the big takeaway for me on this, having kind of been heavily engaged with OSU, is we've really been able to increase our impact in Corvallis. Just yesterday, Corvallis was launched or came out in the papers that Corvallis beat Seattle as the fourth most innovative city. And it really has to do a lot with patents, but it has a lot to do with the UVDF and how it actually has transitioned a lot of companies out of the university into this realm. The forecast, as you heard, is potentially a zero fiscal impact because we have all of these opportunities that are already going forward. Just the tip of them started to repay at this point. We've got a long list of companies that are in progress right now that can keep that turn going, and we expect to see significant returns in the near future. So with that, I appreciate your time again, and then I'll turn it over. We brought an entrepreneur with us, and I'd like to turn it over to him to share his experience.
Please. Thank you, Chairman Roblin. My name is Mike Marusich. I'm the founder and chief scientific officer for MabDX, which is a diagnostic assay development company. It's a spin-out from the University of Oregon. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the UVDF and to provide you with some concrete evidence of the benefits that it has provided and can provide. So my background is in basic research. It's in cell and molecular biology. I was a researcher at the University of Oregon for almost 30 years. During that time, I founded the university's monoclonal antibody facility, and during that process, I had the opportunity to work with a lot of very talented collaborators and researchers, and we generated many inventions and new materials. These are monoclonal antibodies, which, without going into great detail, are proteins that are able to very specifically recognize other molecules. They are therefore very good detection reagents. They're very useful for research. You can measure vanishingly small amounts of substances. They're used in medical tests, like, say, measuring levels of insulin in the blood, that sort of a thing. The monoclonal antibodies we made were licensed. Many of them were licensed by the university's tech transfer office, and they generated a revenue stream of royalties and license fees that started back in the early 90s, actually, and it's continuing on to this day. I'm no longer at the university, but that revenue stream is still continuing. In 2003, partner and I started my first spin-out company, which is MitoSciences. And MitoSciences was based really on these technologies that were developed in my laboratory. We licensed some of these materials from the university, and we built them up, and as part of that deal, the university got an equity stake in the company. We received some of the early UVDF funding, and that really helped us a lot move these things along and grow the company. The company was quite successful, and in 2011, we sold the company to a larger company, and so that was really good, but even better as a continuing success story for the university, that company kept MitoSciences in its location at the Riverfront Research Park because they really valued the team that we had put together. There are now about 35 people working there, ranging from PhD-level people to managers to technicians. MitoSciences also continues to pay licensing fees back to the university. So it's a real ongoing success story. My new company is MapDX, and it is, again, at a very early stage. And again, I've been fortunate and have received some UFVDF funding. This funding is a little bit different. It's in as a result of some collaborative work that I'm doing, actually, with researchers at Oregon State University. It's Mark Lead. He's a professor in the College of Pharmacology at Oregon State. And together with Dr. Lead, we are developing a diagnostic test for head and neck cancer. And the UVDF funding was really critical to move this work forward from beyond where we had gotten it early in our collaboration. If this work succeeds, both the University of Oregon and OSU will receive royalty revenues. Hopefully it'll be quicker than the 8 years that it took us to grow MitoSciences, but it's quite a long, long path. My company also has another collaboration with a different group at Oregon State, at this time in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And this is another diagnostic test, and it's nearing completion. This one is not for human diseases, however. It's a test that will help us save little baby oysters, and not just any oysters, but Oregon oysters. And that's really, I think, an important point. So this is a rapid test for bacterial infection that is a big problem in shellfish hatcheries. And you may be aware, but aquaculture is a large, large growing component of agriculture. And in the U.S., shellfish aquaculture actually accounts for about two-thirds of the total revenues generated by marine aquaculture. And of that, oyster aquaculture is really the largest component. And the Northwest is really the major source for oyster and shellfish aquaculture. Washington State is the big brother there, and Oregon is a much smaller player. But there are shellfish farms down in Coos Bay and on the Oregon coast. There is a hatchery up in Tillamook. We were just up there on Tuesday visiting them and setting up a sampling regimen. And so this test, I'm really excited about it because it's taking an Oregon technology, something coming out of the of Oregon State University, and it's going to bring revenues back, hopefully, to Oregon State and help my company grow. And it will also have a direct impact on local Oregon companies and help them produce more oysters for us all. Plus, it's just a lot of fun to get out there and muck around in the tides. So I could go on, have quite a few other things going on, but just to bring this to conclusion, I'd like to state that in my experience, the UVDF funding has been very, very important, and it's really helped us grow faster, and I just urge the committee to continue the funding and increase it. Thank you again.
Thank you. And we'll wait for questions until our third person. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and Senators. My name is Charles Williams, or Chuck Williams. I'm Associate Vice President for Innovation at the University of Oregon, and I've been at the University of Oregon for almost 8 years, so I got to see the start of the UVDF program when it kicked off. And Mike is a very modest entrepreneur. He has the greenest thumb for making antibodies of anybody I've ever seen. So we're real fortunate to have Mike in our community. And one of the interesting clusters that you see in Eugene is this research tools cluster. So some of you may be familiar with molecular probes, which became Invitrogen, which is now Thermo Fisher. But there are a lot of other companies in the area, including MitoSciences, which has remained, and then Mike's second entrepreneurial adventure, MapDex. So we really start to think about how we leverage the things that we're good at and how do we make the nation and become more internationally renowned in those areas. And part of what some of these early UVDF funds help us do is to leverage those kinds of talents and to show others that we are investing alongside with the company from Britain, the group from Asia, all those things that come together to say we are a hot spot for this kind of activity. So it's always been great working with Mike, and appreciate his coming up here to testify. I was asked to talk a little bit in detail about what we would like to see as amendments for the proposed reauthorization. And I think there are four key issues for the universities. And a lot of these are things that we've kind of learned as the bumpy parts of the road have hit us as we've played around with this initial UVDF program. The first is we would love to see this extended to 2023, primarily so that we could be a part of more of the economic development tax credits versus where we're at now. I think that fits better the idea behind the original UVDF legislation. The second part is we'd like to collapse the what is now a three-year program to get your deduction as a philanthropist, collapse that down to 1 year. And what we experienced, particularly with corporations in Oregon, was a real reluctance to engage in trying to administratively deal with a three-year deduction. And so we don't, any of the schools, we don't really have a lot of corporate participation. And we think that there's an untapped well there for us to be able to get to. But we've had a lot of feedback there that if it could be simplified, if it could be something that they could take in a one-year period, that would do us a lot of good. And we've had the same kinds of comments from individuals who have donated to the program at the different institutions that, you know, it's a lot for them to think about. And our development officers, it's hard for them to explain a three-year tax credit program. So in looking at that, what we would love to have is a change from 3 years to 1 year for that tax credit to be available. And I believe there's also an error in the SB 44 where we would want to see that change from $50,000 to $150,000. So that would actually really just be a clarification that it's the entire amount in 1 year that would be available. The third point is we'd like to expand the program to be $15 million in credits from the current $6 million. We believe that we have capacity to do that. Oregon State really has been leading the way. We're gearing up to do that this year at the University of Oregon. I've just revamped my committee, advisory committee, and my faculty committees to put a couple of programs together to hand out money. And we'd like to be able to follow on with greater programs. So we think that would be a fabulous way for us to take advantage of the resurgent economy. And what I think is a groundswell of interest in entrepreneurship in the state. And so we want to keep that momentum going. And again, that would also benefit all eight universities in the mix. And then lastly, we needed to figure out an allocation method if we were going to have additional tax credit capacity available. And what we'd like to do is be able to review that on an annual basis with our vice presidents of research so that we can have some flexibility. And if one of the schools is making great strides at one particular time, if anyone else has capacity, that we can shift that over to the school that's running fast and vice versa. Later on, one of the other schools may come up and need that capacity as well. So we're looking to have that partnership flexibility in the future. And all of our institutions, I work with Brian and Joe in the back here all the time. We're a pretty networked group of tech transfer offices, and we see a great need for that capacity, and we think we can use it all. And I think that is the extent of my comments, so thank you.
Questions? Oh, Senator Hess.
thanks to both of you for your work on this and your entrepreneurship. And I was just wondering if you could give us show us a glimpse of the mechanics, how this works, who writes the check, how the credits are purchased and claimed.
Sure. So I think all of us handle it through our foundations, respectively. So our foundation works with our advancement or development offices. They have statutory or regulatory that there's a system in place that governs how those tax credits get issued. The letters go out formally to the donor and give them all the specifics that go with that. And then we each have a specific program by which we designate how those dollars will be spent internally. So, for example, at the University of Oregon, we have an external advisory committee of entrepreneurs. So we have three entrepreneurs from our region, one in biotech, one in IT, and one kind of at large. And then we've got a faculty-based committee that has a number of administrators. It's 10 folks. And we put out a request for proposal for the different types of asks that we're going to look for. At the University of Oregon, we have a translational research grant program, so we will put out requests for proposals for the faculty members that want to apply, and there are specific rules and milestones about what they need to achieve in order to continue to get the grant that we're giving them. We have a venture launch grant program, and that's for the startups that have already spun out. And they have to put together a proposal that our committees review, and they decide whether or not that merits the investment by the university. And then we have a third bin, which is dedicated to experiential education. And that has typically at the University of Oregon gone to the Technology Entrepreneurship Program that is administered by our Business Innovation Institute. But we are right now looking at how we might spread those dollars more widely. We've also funded some student internships into some of the startup companies. Our most recent grant to BT Biotech has a product design student as well as an MBA student that will go in and be working with that company specifically. Mike's company, Mitosciences, and Mabdex have for years had interns and other students. There's a lot of crosstalk and experiential education that's a part of that puzzle as well. I might defer to Brian to talk a little bit about Oregon State's program because they've got a very extensive use. But I'll follow up, Mr.
Chairman. Yeah, I have a follow-up first.
Curious about if I'm do I purchase the credit from one of your foundations? Is it discounted? How does that part work? If one of us are interested in the tax benefits of buying these credits, how does that part work? How do you solicit those people?
So that's entirely through our advancement group that our development officers would work with a potential donor to decide whether it's the UVDEF is an opportunity that they want to take advantage of. We've got a website that has all the details on how the tax credit works and a calculator as well that people can look at. And the development officer will walk them through what it would mean and how they would get the tax credit information.
Squeeze right there. We're going to put one more person in there to answer that same question. Yeah, a little more depth over there from a statewide perspective.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it's an 80% tax credit.
Sure. And it is. So I donate to this, so I know pretty well how this works. First off, yeah, it is handled by our foundation. They solicit through their website. We put on sessions publicly. And we have a network, of course, of alum and well beyond OSU or any of the universities to attract potential donors. As someone who donates, you receive a federal deduction as well as the state tax credit. And the state tax credit is 60% right now over a three-year period. So if I, provide $1,000, I'll take the deduction. I'll get an immediate 20% state tax credit the following year. I've got to remember to take the next tax credit, and then the next year, same thing.
20% off your $1,000?
Right, 20%, 20%, 20%. So at the end of the day, it depends on the tax brackets that any individual's in, but you're still out of, say, $1,000 example, you may be out about $100 at the end of the three-year period, somewhere in there.
What do you mean they're out? The donor?
The donor, yes. Chair Roseland, Senator House. Yeah. The donor is donating money to this, so they're not expecting any return personally other than taking a federal deduction or state tax credit.
Why is there a state expense here?
There's a state expense in terms of the tax credit that's provided to the donor, to incentivize donors to actually donate.
If the donor is going to lose money and is not benefiting, the benefit goes to the company? I mean, it's very, very small. I'm not
sure.
I'm just trying to figure it out in my mind.
Right. So why would a donor be interested in donating to this program, for example?
Why would they be interested? And then if the donor doesn't make any money or there's no benefit to him, then where does the state? Why would a donor be interested?
We're finding more and more donors that are particularly attracted to the idea of seeing an impact in the state of Oregon through entrepreneurship. That's the number one driver that we see. I engage with potential donors quite frequently towards the end of the calendar year, and I always ask what their interest is, how did they learn about it, and it really is, they'll sit with their accountant and look at all the other tax credits that's available in the state, and there's better tax credits if you just are looking for a dollar-to-dollar deal. But generally speaking, they like the idea of having this endeavor create jobs and create companies and help the entrepreneurship and kind of fill that gap that's missing. These are folks that generally are in business. They understand the need for bridging that gap between federal funding and investors, and they know that they feel like we're handling it well to actually help create that impact. The following stages, of course, they're actually interested in potentially investing in companies if they do spin out. That's just another non-state related potential fund that could be built to accommodate that as individual investors.
Follow up. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we are going to be looking at this issue at the tax credit level, the next stop here. But it kind of begs the question as we look at $64 million of tax credits that will expire and how we're going to squeeze. We have $14 million to pay for them. If people are donating on their own and at a cost to them, why is the state even involved?
There has been no program in the past that is set up to attract donors to this. So we're finding that the tax credit is enough of incentive to get them over the hurdle to donate to a program like this. If it were standalone, there were no tax credit involved, and it was simply a donation. From what I hear from our foundation, we raised $1 million last year. Their expectations would be we wouldn't raise 10% of what we raised. It really is the tax credit that drives the donors to this, in combination with what the fund is about. So they're looking at a range of tax credits, and generally, a lot of times the donors we find are utilizing several tax credits. But this is the reason they're willing to, I guess, spend money, additional money on this as opposed to going a different route, is because they like what this does.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Don't mean to put you on the spot.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just comment. I think that this is something that the state gets a real benefit back out of. Many of the states that are successfully spinning out companies out of the research done in their universities, getting an ROI on that, have funds like this. And I think the Senator Hass's comments, we're actually kind of, rather than funding the development fund completely directly, we're getting a little bit of a private investment out of it based on, frankly, the goodwill of people who are interested in development of business and probably like the university, and sort of it's a way to put money into there rather than into something else, whether that would be athletics or something else. And this is a place where they have an interest and are willing to donate money. But the important thing for me is this is – I was just looking at your exhibits that you put in here, and in a very short period of time, you've got 26, I think it is, companies into three universities that have spun out, and that's the kind of development that we need in the state. They're not all, I'd love to say that they're all going to be greatly successful. That's probably not true, but if we just hit, one or two home runs out of that, that's a real biggie. And you mentioned molecular probes in Eugene that started. I was involved when they started out there, just two researchers that aligned with the University of Oregon from Austin, Texas, and that now is Oregon's largest biotech company. I mean, it can pay, and they pay really well. So, it's good stuff. And I think the other, targeted labs that we've funded through ONAMI and Otrati and some of those, we're finally getting to the point where we may start smartly getting some return on the public dollar investment and creating the kinds of jobs and replacing the lost manufacturing jobs that we've seen over the last couple of decades. So I think it's a really good program and very worthwhile and relatively inexpensive in the scheme of things.
And my question, and I don't know if you have that information on hand or just whatever you do have. I know that a number of our universities now count as one of their funding, their streams of money, dollars coming back for patents and other kinds of things that the universities have done. And I don't think people recognize how much of the work that's done in laboratories, like you were in before, develop a patent, and since they did it at the university, that patent then, if it's used in some place, brings money, resources back to the state. Do we have any idea what kind of funding that is for the state? Mm-hmm.
Chair Roblin, good question. I think each university tracks their own metrics, and I can answer for OSU and speculate on a couple others, but I'll let Chuck, since he's sitting here, answer for his. OSU generated approximately $6 million last year from patent activity. We hold equity in a handful of companies. Once there was a bill that launched in 2003 that allowed us to accept equity, if you think about the timeline that we're laying out, we've got equity in a handful of companies that we haven't liquidated yet, so it'll be interesting to see how those play out. If you're familiar with NuScale Power, that's one of an OSU startup company that has 550 employees at this point, and that's one that we're waiting to see how that plays out for OSU.
You also have some
cheese
glue.
We have some formaldehyde-free adhesives that we license and generate.
That's coming along. So.
Yeah, all of these kind of come into the pool of money that we actually use. Our offices are generally self-sustaining for the most part. We have some limited support from universities, but we use a lot of funding to actually self-sustain and take risks on to fund patents. And sometimes, at least my office, will even put in some extra money than the UVDF just to try to get it to where we think it needs to be, depending on the year that we're having.
And a lot of that work was done just before they tried to commercialize it.
Yeah.
So they had the patent, they had the idea, they got it ready to go, and then they stopped because there was no funding in that little place between there and actually putting it into production. And that's what this fund is really about.
It really is. And we work very collaboratively with the Signature Research Center. So, you know, I know the state provides direct funding to ONAMI, Oregon Best, and Otrati. We have representatives of those on our advisory council. When we're making investment decisions, I'll look at Skip Rung from ONAMI and ask, hey, if we put some UVDF in and show that we're de-risking it enough for you, will you maybe consider investing in the next? And so we work very collaboratively to all in trying to get these companies formed and staying in the state of Oregon. But a lot of times the SRCs are moving further beyond now. They're taking equity as well. They're kind of pushing the boundaries to create jobs, and so they're looking for us to take a little more risk on than they are, and so that's why the collaboration between the two funds is critically important.
Everyone wants somebody else to take the risk.
That's
on.
Right, especially
the Chair Roman, yes. So the University of Oregon's license revenue was about $7 million last year. We have a different portfolio. We're not a med school, not an engineering college, so we have a very robust portfolio out of the College of Education. About 30% of our research funding actually goes to researchers in the College of Education. And it's a mix of both inventions, things that are patented, copyrighted works, as well as actual retention of materials. So in the instance of Mitosciences, we held the hybridomas that Mike had created in the monoclonal antibody facility. And so those were bailed, or we actually had those control, those assets. So we didn't have actually any patents in that particular play. Yet it turned out to be financially very, very good. So there's a lot of different ways you can handle information assets. We take a pretty broad approach to that. But we've been fairly successful in creating a self-sustaining environment, but very targeted patent portfolio. What we're hoping to do, as Brian mentioned, is to use the UVDF in these early stages to leverage all the other investments and other groups that are coming to our regional accelerator and innovation network and wanting to be a part, but trying to hook them together in a seamless way so that we don't have as many bumps trying to get these companies through that chute.
So you mentioned education. Is Dibbles part of the
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you are getting some of that resources comes in from that program.
We do. Dibbles, we have positive behavioral support is a very big license. In fact, our positive behavioral support is in the Netherlands, Denmark, places that can afford education.
Yes, Senator. No, okay. Any other questions for this group?
No question. I agree with Senator Byers' comments. It just makes Senator Gelser and my job much harder as we start trying to slim these tax credits down in a few months.
I'm no longer on tax credits.
That's right, you're off.
So you can do all the work yourself.
That's where you get the big bucks.
I guess I have to ask one other question, because in some of the conversations we've had before we came here today, one of the ideas was to change the tax credit from being a 3-year tax credit to narrowing it down, and I think that's here. Just so people who are in this position know, by spreading it out, you don't have to spend it all in the same biennium. What is the thinking there with you with respect to this tax credit for you guys?
Chair Roblin, we've had starting to have some success with a lot of dedicated effort. It's been difficult, though, specific, Chuck mentioned, with corporations as well as actually investors who generally don't like to push things over a three-year period. It's just very difficult to fundraise with a three-year tax credit. And so you see that, you know, each university has had different successes on doing that. But the consistent theme we hear from each of our foundations and each person that I talk with is 3 years. If it was one, we would be willing to provide even more and do more because we know what we're getting and where we're at today. We don't know what our funding status or what our taxes are going to look like 3 years from now, so we're just not willing to go there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Next bill. So anybody else that was sitting in the audience and didn't sign up and that would like to talk about Senate Bill 44? Oh, here we go. Come on in.
For the record, Deanna Mack with Oregon Department of Revenue, and we do administer the mechanics of this tax credit. And you heard a lot of testimony today about the need to clean that specific provision up. And we tend to agree it is confusing and it has some unusual carry forward provisions. So we would like to offer our services to help you figure out that component, if you wish.
Thank you. That gets into this tax credit world, and I don't want to cross-pollinate here, but that would be helpful, maybe 3 years into one, or what would make more sense in terms of efficiency. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the beauties of this tax credit bill, is that doesn't mean these bills have to live or die, but in many cases, they can be improved. So I would love to see perhaps an amendment that you can work with Gretchen on. And
we're happy to work with you on making sure that works for taxpayers in the tax return process.
Representative Byer. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, what kind of experience do you have? That's asking it the wrong way. I guess what I don't know. Is there a lot of issues that come up with these multi-year tax credits, people being confused, hard for the department to figure out whether there's an eligibility there or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's a great question. They are more complicated when there's carry forward provisions. It also the way we track them, it's difficult to tell how many are still outstanding. And I think Chris from Alanac from LRO might be able to speak to that component a little bit better. But taxpayers, and this particular credit does have some strange language. It doesn't actually have what we call as a carry forward provision.
That's what I was just going to ask you about.
A carry forward is where you don't use all of the tax credit in a certain year, you can carry it over into another year. Generally, tax credits have specific language that says that you may carry it forward, you know, 3 years or 5 years or 6 years or however long you choose to do that. This particular credit doesn't do that, but instead it says you have to take it over 3 years, and it's limited to the taxpayer's liability in 1 year. So there's some ambiguity about whether it is, you know, you heard testimony about being $150,000 credit, $50,000 each year is limited to your tax liability, or whether it is allowed to be claimed over all years until all 60% of the credit is used. So the way the statute is currently drafted, there is some ambiguity there. So the example would be if you have $1 million credit or $1 million donation, and you have a $600,000 credit. Most people, individuals, don't have that much liability. So the question would be, is it $150,000, or do they take $50,000 every year until all 12 years use up the $600,000? So we would be happy to work with you to help understand exactly how that credit is supposed to work, and get some standard carry-forward language in there if that's what you intend, because there is some ambiguity there.
I could see where there would be a lot of confusion about that, and the gentleman's discussion where you're sitting down with somebody, their development officers, and saying it'd be a really good thing to do. And they're sitting there with their CPA saying, yeah, this is a good year, but I don't know about next year or the 3 years
much
out.
Much less 12 years from now.
You know, kind of like, I don't know. You know, if there's not a carry forward, you could, the economy changes a lot.
Yes.
Senator, they could end up losing the whole tax credit.
Right. Senator Bitcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this part of the bill that we probably need to work on in another committee, or do we want to?
No, we could actually get closer here.
I got to deal with it one way or the other.
I would say that we have a chance to do that here, okay. And especially if it makes us more comfortable with the policy, from the policy perspective, then it would go over to the tax credits, and if they needed to do it one more time, they'd have a little bit of time to get that figured out. And for two reasons that's important. Tax credit stays open longer with respect to these bills, and they can actually work on them more. But if we identify the problems and get an amendment that gets us there, they have a little longer to look at it and see if it actually
I don't care. I'm just asking the right question. Where do we fix that part?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, this is a relatively new law. I think it's 4 years old, and this dynamic, it used to be these tax credits were there forever, and it was very hard to repeal the bad ones because it was a three-fifths vote, because it was technically a raise in tax. So now, because of this change, they have to come in front of us and make their case to continue for another 6 years. And so that changes everything. And the result has been not that a lot of tax credits are dying, although some have, but that they're improved. And I think this is the opportunity. We're still trying to find our sea legs in terms of policy committees recommending these to the tax credit committee, though.
Okay. So we can help set the standard for getting it right before we send it over to you.
So we'll know the revenue impacts in this committee.
We have to. I mean, that's one of the bills. Yeah, come on up. Please.
Chair Roveland, members of the committee, just to kind of reemphasize the point, and that's part of the new dynamic with this report and LRO's role, is so that if the policy committees are focusing on the policy and whatever mechanics play into that discussion, that's great, but there is going to be a line probably that the committee will decide, okay, yeah, this is too much of tinkering with the mechanics of it, we're good on the policy, and then this is for JTAX. But there certainly can be aspects to the policy, because keeping the policy goal in mind, the structure of the tax credit can absolutely have an impact on the success or failure of that policy. And to the extent that you guys that the committee is discussing those policy aspects, that's where we would provide you real-time, at least ballpark estimates of what it would do to the revenue impact, whether you go from a three-year credit. I mean, as the chair noted, you go from a three-year structure to a one-year structure, you condense the revenue impact. And there are a lot of those aspects that is really the intent of, as we understand it from leadership, about the dynamic during the policy discussion. So as much as that can be played out here, great. And then even a step further, given the budgetary constraints, if you will, that, okay, here's the ideal policy, and, you know, the committee would prefer a one-year credit at $1 million. So if there's some sort of prioritization that the policy committee would provide JTAX, that would be helpful for JTAX.
Thank you, Bill. Okay. I think this got implemented, this whole idea of this, a number of years ago, basically when we had the co-chairs, and we were trying to come up with a way to deal with tax credits when we gave them $10 million. And it was kind of like, you got to be kidding. They did amazing jobs. They figured out ingenious ways to figure out how to get that $10 million. And I think it made the process better. And I think this is how that's moving forward. And I appreciate it. So I appreciate you being here. And it's good for the policy people who are not on any of these other, you know, revenue or ways and means to actually start understanding that this stuff is happening. So, okay. Thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on, at Senate Bill 530. Was that one we were just on? Yeah. 44. Close that one. And we have two senators vying for the moment. We will start with Senator Monroe, which is
SJR 2.
So we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 2. Thank you, Senator Girard. Just so that everybody knows, he's been very patient. And, we appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. President. excuse me, Mr. Chair. Been dealing with too many issues today. I'm Senator Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, with a bit of a cold. SGR2 is a very simple measure. It simply purports to treat possible personal kickers in the future the way we treat corporate kickers today. And with the amendment that is presented, the Dash 1 amendment would simply send any future personal kickers to the Education Stability Fund. This is the appropriate, I've had many talks with Senator Burdick, for example, who's had ideas about dealing with the kicker and so on, and she has ideas that it ought to go into a rainy day fund. But the Education Stability Fund is the place to send it. And the reason is that everybody cares about funding education, and that building up that fund so that the next time the economy drops, we'll have some revenue to backfill so we don't have to lay off teachers and put more and more kids into a classroom. This is just prudent responsibility. It's a referral. The kicker's in the Constitution, so it takes a vote of the public to change it. So it's a referral. It follows the admonition of the book of Exodus, where Joseph had interpreted a dream. And the dream was about seven fat cows and seven skinny cows. And Joseph interpreted the dream as saying there will be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And the Pharaoh was smart enough to put Joseph in charge of collecting the foodstuffs, the grain and other things, and filling the barns during the 7 years of plenty so that there would be grain for the 7 years of poverty. And it worked. And during that time of that great recession back in those days, you had people coming from all over the world to Egypt because they were the only place in the Mediterranean that actually had grain. So anyway, I would urge you to send this, amend it with the Dash 1, then send it on down to Rules, who have to approve all joint resolutions.
Questions? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, do you also support a constitutional spending limit?
No.
Yeah, and I think that would be the problem, because without the kicker, there is no limit on government's ability to tax and spend, and the kicker is the only thing that stops that. So it's in the Constitution. You're welcome. And I think it should stay there. So maybe we should set this over to, like, 2025?
Well, at Senator, the same time, the kicker would still be there. Wouldn't the
this
kicker
is why it's
there?
A referral. It has to go to the voters so the voters can decide whether you're right or I'm right.
Any other questions? I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You bet.
Is there anyone that would like to speak to SJR 2? No one out there for that one. Okay. Thank you very much. We will close our public hearing on SGR 2. We will open a public hearing on SB 530. And with that, Senator Girard.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knope, Senator Fred Girard, I represent District 9, which is the largest Senate district in the Willamette Valley. I just want you to know that I envy each and every one of you sitting on this committee. I think education is changing dramatically, and I think you can have a big part on it. The reason I was not anxious to come up, I was really interested in the science technology that they were talking about. It's really fascinating. And I think that we can change things for the better, and I think we have to. Education has really suffered in this state. If you look at our funding, you'll see that higher education and community colleges, we just haven't done an adequate job. And the end result is we have people paying bills. I just don't think they should. Now, I lived a life of education. My parents were both teachers. They went on to do business, but they started as teachers. I had 10 years of post-secondary education. Trust me, it was not always the greatest time of my life. I starved through some of it. You know, the story of a starving student, that's sort of true. I mean, you really put yourself out there. You give a lot of things up, you know, and I couldn't always go out on a date. I'd have a girlfriend, but I'd have to stay home and study. They really go through a lot of turmoil. Now, I'm not saying that college isn't fun, because I did have fun in certain parts of it. But I think what's happened now, because of the lack of funding, is that we have really put a lot of debt on students. And I feel personally responsible for that to a certain degree. I'm of the generation that benefited, and it seems to me like we're putting onto this new generation debt that they shouldn't have. Now, with all the education that I had, I spent, I was in the hole about $10,000 when I was a dentist. Now, that was a long time ago. Inflation would probably make that about $50,000. The average dentist now is at least $150,000. We heard stories of $200,000 in state, as high as $400,000. You know, the return on the investment is terrible. For them to try to make a go of it right out of school is really difficult. So because of the fairness issue, and that's what I'm looking at, how can we impact those people that are being hurt the most by our policies? I came up with the idea of giving a tax credit on the interest, not on the whole loan, just on the interest for student loans. Now, there's a couple good things that happen of this, and one is, well, I'll just give it as an example. If we put a lot of money in, say, at Oregon State, in an engineering student, and he goes off to Florida, we as a state really don't benefit. But if somebody from Florida comes up to Oregon with a lot of debt, we benefit. So the more that we attract, the more that we benefit. This will help with our workforce development in attracting people to this state. We've put $200 million into OHSU. That's going to become a hub. Oregon, as you heard here just a few minutes ago, they're a bit of a hub. Oregon State's a hub. And we really need to go out and do everything that we can to encourage the younger crowd to go to school. It should pay, but it's getting to the point where that's been marginalized. So, again, this is a very simple bill. I understand revenue has some questions. To me, it's you get a tax credit on the interest, and that would be after the federal tax would come off, you know, but that would be on the remaining part. So it's a very simple bill. I'd like it to go to revenue so that we could at least have the discussion as to what the cost of this would be. And we underfund the Oregon Opportunity Grant. There's a lot of things that we just can't afford, but this might be a way to kind of give back to the people that I think truly deserve it.
Any questions? I guess the only one I have is that it seems like you're giving a 0% interest loan if you're tax crediting back all of the interest they're going to pay over the life of their loan.
Well,
would you say that is kind of what you've...
Well, not 100% true, because the federal tax is tax deductible. Okay. So that's what I intended. So this would be the interest paid after the federal tax deduction.
After the federal tax, okay.
Yeah, so you're right, and it would be zero interest after the federal tax deduction.
Right.
But interest rates are fairly low right now, so.
That's true.
Yeah, it might have such a hefty price tag, we can't do it, and we can only do a partial tax credit instead of a full tax credit. I don't know the numbers, you know, and I don't think anybody else here does. And I'm really struggling as I go into retirement, looking at the debt load that these kids are taking. Lawyers are coming up, they're having a hard time finding a job, and they have $200,000 worth of debt. I just think that's wrong. I'm sorry.
I don't expect you to be sorry. It's okay.
Oh, I knew. I knew the Chair Roblin part was tough.
Any other questions for Senator Girard? Thank you very much, Senator Girard.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? who didn't have a chance. Oh, we got two. That's right. One more. Eric Knoll.
Thank you, Eric.
And I saw you sneak in, and I didn't even realize that.
Thank you. Right. So, good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll. I am the student body president at Portland State University, and I'm here representing the Oregon Student Association. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. The Oregon Student Association is a statewide student-run, student-led, nonpartisan, and organizing advocacy group founded in 1975 to represent, serve, and protect the collective interests of students in post-secondary education in Oregon, and to work for a more affordable and accessible higher education in Oregon. And I'm here to talk briefly about the impact of student debt on students in Oregon, and what potential we can possibly see from Senate Bill 530. So we focus on higher education a lot in terms of funding, of what the tuition rate is or how many students have access to higher education. But it's also equally important to focus on what the life is like for students who leave our colleges and universities, especially those who leave with student debt, and the increasing amount of student debt that we're seeing among graduates of Oregon's public community colleges and universities. We have to ask ourselves questions after they graduate. What kind of return will they be able to provide to the economy with an average of $25,000, $26,000 in student loan debt? What kind of ability will they have to buy homes or to place in jobs that they're actually seeking, or ones that are just there to help them pay off their loans? We also recognize that we're seeing little to no federal political will to deal with the student loan crisis, or the student loan debt crisis, I should say. And that we're happy to see an interest from members of the Legislative Assembly here in the state of Oregon, including Senator Girard and Senate Bill 530. And think while we recognize there's no kind of silver bullet to addressing the cost and the increasing price sensitivity among students in higher education and leaving higher education, we can look at this as an opportunity to start the conversation and look at this as a way to start a potential solution. So I thank you very much for your time, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
So, any questions? So has the association taken a particular position on this particular bill?
To my knowledge, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, to my knowledge, the way our student organization works is that because it's student-run, student-led, we have to talk with our board members and get their stance. So we haven't taken an official stance, but look favorably to the bill as we're here in support of Senate Bill 530.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to talk to Senate Bill 530? I didn't see any before. Okay. Then we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 530. It is the intention of the chair to talk with the sponsors of these bills, and if there are amendments and other things that they feel are important, we'll try to give them some guidance. We have some people from LRO and others that are willing to help, and so we'll make sure that they have the contact information for them to come up with things that they think might be better. And then at a future date, if it's changed a lot, we'll probably have a public hearing and a work session. If it's just minor changes, we'll probably just have a work session at some point when they're all ready. So with that, that's pretty much it, right? Well, that's right. I do need to put together my work group, and I didn't get that finished, so we'll do that. But we do have a list of all the people, so I should that's too big a group, I think. So we have, just so people know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. There's about 20 people who have put their name on the work group for the OEIB. I will get a hold of people individually and let them know, because we're going to cut this down. So that we have a deal, because I don't think we have enough room for all of them to have a real conversation. So, with that, I will adjourn the meeting for the Senate Education Committee.
Have a little insurance bill. Very well. Life.
Thank you all for being here.
Not that bad. I'm not sure. Insurance bill. Very well. Life.